One of the most successful private schools in Afghanistan is located in a poor neighborhood on the outskirts of Kabul. The Marifat School offers a progressive education to its 4,000 students, both girls and boys. And journalist Jeffrey Stern's new book, The Last Thousand, One School's Promise in a Nation at War, is about the school and about the uncertain future that it has when the U.S. military leaves Afghanistan. In her review in the New York Times this week, Jennifer Senior wrote that the book is meticulously reported and explains the confusing geopolitics of the region with a blessed and welcome lucidity. It is published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Jeffrey Stern to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Great to be here.
When did you first travel to Afghanistan?
I first went to Afghanistan in 2007. It was right after I graduated from college, and I went to try to be a freelance journalist.
Many people have done that, and many people have stuck to doing that, but they don't wind up writing books like this. So did you get sidetracked?
I did. I got very sidetracked. It turned out I couldn't quite make a living just writing, so I got a few sort of side jobs in different development capacities, American University of Afghanistan, and over time I formed some relationships with some really special people and institutions.
And also include teaching at the school. At one point.
Correct. Well, teaching in quotations, I was not a very good teacher.
Foreign civilians have been targets even in the safer areas of Afghanistan. Was it dangerous to do this kind of in-depth reporting?
A little bit. I didn't feel constantly at risk. I think a lot of Westerners are able to live and work in Afghanistan with a relatively low level of risk if they're smart, although, of course, that's beginning to change now.
It also depends on what part of Afghanistan you're in.
Right.
Kabul
yeah.
is probably safer than most.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
How did you meet Aziz Rayesh, who was to become the founder and headmaster of, is it Marifat?
Right, Marifat School. So one of the unique things about my experience in Afghanistan is because I needed to find a job to put a roof over my head while I was there, I ended up working for the American University of Afghanistan, and my boss was an Afghan. He was a naturalized American, but born and raised in Afghanistan. And so, whereas a lot of foreigners had a lot of Afghans working for them, I was a foreigner who was working for an Afghan. He happened to be a member of this ethnic group, the Hazaras. I didn't know it at the time. I don't think I really understood, you know, the ethnic nuance of the country. But he, of course, knew of this school because the school primarily served members of this ethnic group, and that's how I ended up there.
Afghanistan is a multi-ethnic society. Primarily Pashtun, the large number of Tajiks. Hazaras are the third largest group?
Yeah, that's right.
Hazaras have been victimized by both the Taliban and ISIS. Why have they been picked on?
They have a number of things, a number of sins associated with them. One of them is that they are Shia. Afghanistan is majority Sunni. That's partially a problem because Iran is just next door. So Hazaras, some with justification and some not, are associated with Iran. It's often considered to be agents of Iran.
But most of the Hazaras we've heard about recently were in Iraq, and they were targeted by ISIS. They were forced to up a mountain, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things. Hazaras especially because they look different. So in Afghanistan, you have Tajiks, you have Pashtuns, you have people who look, physically, they look more or less the same. And then you have Hazaras who look Mongol. They have Asiatic features. So not only are they Shia, but they're easily identifiable as different. And then probably most damningly, they helped us.
Now, they look like Mongols. That's one of the reasons for the title of this book, The Last Thousand. Is it just a legend that the Hazaras are descended from a unit of 1,000 of Genghis Khan's troops who stayed behind after he left?
Yeah, it's a neat story. I think there's probably some truth to it. It's a little bit oversimplified, but of course the story is that because Genghis Khan would divide his armies up into units of 10, 100, 1,000, that after an invasion of what's now Afghanistan, he left behind this rear guard of 1,000 troops. 1,000 in Persian, in Farsi, is Hazar. So the word Hazara is basically means 1,000, and it's sort of a neat history. And I think because it's a neat history and it sort of makes sense, it's stuck as the dominant theory, whether or not it's totally true.
They were one of the minority communities that continued to fight the Taliban longest. What happened after the Taliban took over the country?
Well, a lot of Hazaras left. A lot of Hazaras fled to either Iran or to Pakistan or to the West. A lot weren't able to, but essentially they became even more second-class citizens than they already were, really, because, again, they were Shia. The Taliban was practicing a strict Wahhabist form of Sunni Islam.
And the Taliban are Pashtun. Relations between Hazaras and Pashtun were part of the plot of the novel The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So people, many readers, will know a bit about this story from that book.
Correct. Yeah. So the character Hassan in The Kite Runner is a Hazara. The I guess it's the narrator has a, I guess a servant. I think a servant family that lives with them, and those are Hazaras. And that sort of rhymes with the modern history of Afghanistan, where Hazaras have traditionally been in kind of the servile class.
But in the current situation, haven't many Hazaras achieved success because of the American occupation?
Yeah, exactly.
In the army, there even some people in top government positions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's been this sort of explosion of success from within the Hazara community. They've really seized on the opportunity that the U.S.-led coalition kind of created. And you're exactly right. Now they're in top government posts. They have started businesses. People are going to college. And this is a community of people that were literally banned from higher education, that 100 years ago were enslaved. So it's a really remarkable success story in a pretty short period of time.
My guest is Jeffrey E. Stern. His book, The Last Thousand, One School's Promise in a Nation at War, published by St. Martin's Press, is at WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the man you're writing about, Aziz, had no formal education. How did he evolve from being a holy warrior to becoming an educator?
I don't totally know. It's one of these amazing things about him. And he, in a way, is sort of an analog for the entire community because he is so self-taught and he sort of levered himself up into being a teacher.
Well, he's obviously a brilliant man.
He's a brilliant man. He has an indomitable will. And I don't say that lightly. I mean, I'm sort of averse to these kinds of cliches, but he just keeps going. And he was intensely curious. So he left school in the fifth grade. I think he always was sort of felt bad for what he'd missed out on, and he just picked up books wherever he was, and he read them and memorized them and picked them up again, and he sort of picked up and tried on philosophies like we would pick up and try on clothes. And by the time he was mid-20s, I mean, he had collected so much information and so many ways of thinking that he was regarded as the teacher, even though he himself had never finished even the fifth grade.
Didn't he start his school in a Pakistani refugee camp?
Exactly, yeah. He started with 10 or 15 children of weavers, just trying to teach them to read.
And then what happened after it was possible he moved the school to Kabul?
Exactly right. So after the U.S.-led coalition went in and essentially demolished the Taliban were nowhere to be seen for a number of years, he and some of his colleagues decided it was safe to bring the school home for the first time. And they went out to a slum of Kabul where land was almost free and began building up for themselves.
Why did he call the school Marifat?
Well, originally the name was Afshar, and that was named after a massacre of Hazaras that had happened several years before in the mid-90s in Kabul, where thousands of Hazaras had been killed and others had been raped and mutilated. And he decided that he wanted the school to be something that was a little more hopeful, more forward-looking. There had been just so much, you know, death and darkness and destruction and so little cause for hope that he thought the name needed to be something that was forward-looking. And Marifat is one word that has all of these meanings: knowledge, gnosis, wisdom, enlightenment. And so he thought this was the thing that people should associate themselves with.
And we talk about it as a place for progressive education. What is considered progressive education in Afghanistan?
It wouldn't necessarily have taken much, but he felt very adamant that boys and girls studied together. He felt that one of the reasons there had been capacities for such tremendous violence against women was because a lot of young men who later became Talibs were taken into madrasas and separated from women, so they were orphans, so they didn't have access to mothers and fathers.
Would this school be called a madrasa?
No. I mean, when they were building it up, some of the students' parents were upset that there was no prayer room, and Aziz said, it's great for kids to pray, but they should not do it here.
So religion isn't included in the curriculum?
It wasn't. Now there is a Quran class because the Ministry of Education required them to have it in order for them to get their to be registered with the Ministry of Education.
Hasn't the Taliban targeted schools, co-ed schools?
Yeah, I mean,
is this school safer than some?
It's maybe a little bit safer than some because it's so far out in this very crowded Hazara slum, basically, that it's frankly it's hard to get to and it's hard to find.
The school welcomes student participation and questions rather than rote memorization. Is that atypical?
Yeah, it's very atypical. The entire education system is really built around memorizing things and kind of reciting them back to the teacher.
Is there any other school in Afghanistan that would be like this?
There are probably a few, but I've come across one other, and it's a small it was a small boarding school with 15 kids. Certainly not that I've come across that has been built by Afghans.
What ages does it serve?
All ages. In fact, they've recently added an adult literacy program because there's so many women in particular, but women and men, who didn't study because of the war years or because under the Taliban they weren't allowed to. So there's a lot of women who want to learn to read and write and get educated but don't necessarily want to sit next to a bunch of first graders. And so they've recently added this adult learning program, an accelerated adult learning program. So literally it's like 5 or 6 years old all the way up to 40, 50, 60 years old.
Are all the students Hazaras?
Almost all of them are Hazaras.
What was your experience like when you were teaching English at the school? I know you said you modestly said you weren't a very good teacher, but what was the process?
Well, so what had happened is this boss of mine who was a Hazara who was going out once a week to hold classes, and he spoke English perfectly, but he had learned it as a teenager, which meant he knew how to teach it. And I'd never consciously learned English, so I went into this school to fill in for him one day and started trying to come up with a lesson plan, but I realized, I mean, I just didn't know. I didn't know the rules. I remember.
You didn't know what a verb was?
I mean, I the parts of speech I had a hard time remembering. I couldn't, the rules, what O-O, how that sounds, and they were correcting me. Mm-hmm. And they were talking back to me, I mean, in a very endearing way. But there was, you know, there were very kind of odd, like a kid would get up and say, in the name of Allah, and then he would just issue some argument that totally defeated what I'd said. It was this really incredible kind of juxtaposition of kids who were really respectful, but also totally irreverent. And so at the end of one of the classes, one of the kids got up and said, Mr. Jeff, Jafar, actually, they would call me Jafar. I said, Mr. Jafar, we think we've taught you more than you've taught us. They were right.
Well, now you're trying to teach the rest of the world what is going on there. My guest is Jeffrey E. Stern. His book, The Last Thousand, One School's Promise in a Nation at War. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and we will continue our conversation after this. Have you written in with your questions for Marion James yet? On February 17th, the Man Booker Prize-winning author will be here to discuss his career, life in his birth country, Jamaica, and his highly acclaimed novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings. Send us your questions for him now on our show page at WMIC.org/Lopate or on Twitter, where our handle is @LeonardLopate. You're listening to WMIC and WNYC.org. And we are back to Jeffrey E. Stern, who's been named both a Pulitzer Center Fellow for Crisis Reporting and a Graduate Fellow at the Stanford Center for International Conflict and Negotiation. He has written a book called The Last Thousand, One School's Promise in a Nation at War. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Now, when you say that the Hazaras are Shiites, would I recognize them as something like Iranian Shiites, something like Iraqi Shiites? Are there very different, are there variations of Shiism?
There are variations of Shiism. I think that you would recognize them by the way they practice as similar to Iranian Shiism, Twelvers, one of the terms for the 12 Imams. But in Afghanistan, there's a little bit of a divide for the kind of the hearts and minds of the Shiites, of the Hazaras, because there is the sort of Aziz Royesh, the Marifat school's version of education. And there is a lot of Iranian influence through a few ayatollahs that have giant, beautiful madrasas in Kabul and around Afghanistan that are also educating Shias and Hazaras.
But would they also educate girls?
They would educate girls, but in separately. And education is, it would be more of this rote memorization and sort of Quranic studies.
So how did Aziz convince families to send their daughters to his school?
Well, right, one of the ways he did it, sort of expecting some resistance, is he decided to, rather than fight the notion that a lot of people had, that women were a kind of chattel, were property, he decided that the best thing he could do was actually to embrace it. And he went into houses, he went into people's homes himself to try to convince them to let their daughters go to school. And he would behave almost like an investment manager. He would say, if you let your daughter be educated, she'll be able to marry better. And I mean, for the most part, it worked.
Because she would attract a better husband. Somebody.
Right, right.
U.S. General John Allen, the commander of international security forces in Afghanistan, personally donated enough money to Marifat to fund 25 scholarships. What was about the school that was so important to an American like General Allen?
Well, I think one of the things that I put in the book at the beginning is that this school and this person, Aziz Royesh, really reflects the values that we went in there, or at least that we kind of tell each other and tell ourselves we went in there to protect and promote, you know, democracy and human rights and education. He's done it on his own. And it's a way that people who've sacrificed a lot or have been close to the sacrifices that we as a country and our young men and women have made, it's a way we can look and say, at least in this one way, it was worth it.
The United States has deployed 1 million soldiers and civilians over the past 13 years and spent $1 trillion. So we've done segments on the show about how some of that money was spent rather foolishly, mm-hmm. like for park yeah. benches mm-hmm. That most Afghans would not want to sit on.
Right.
But what about a school like Marifat? Does the U.S. see this as a success?
Well, I don't know what the official U.S. position on Marifat would be. It does not receive hardly any aid from us or anyone.
So Aziz hasn't reached out to Americans for support?
Well, he has. He tried at the very beginning. He thought what we would think, well, this looks like just the kind of thing that America would like to support. And so he tried to get support. And actually, one of his first American kind of boosters really encouraged him not to, and to try to make sure that the school was supported both financially and kind of emotionally from within the community.
And who's paying for it?
Students are. They're paying $300 a year tuition, fewer and fewer now because of what's going on in the economy there. But and there have been some small programs which foreigners have helped support. The U.S. Embassy supported an English language program, but that's now ended. So there's been sort of piecemeal programs that foreign organizations have helped support, but the school still runs almost entirely on tuition dollars from the poorest community.
Well, Marifat became one of the most successful schools in the country, with some of its graduates going to colleges like Harvard and Brown and Northwestern. What was their experience like when they came to the U.S.? Were they prepared?
You know, that in terms of the education, remarkably, I think a lot of them were. The idea of kind of critical thinking and writing essays that challenged texts rather than simply memorizing them actually felt pretty natural to a lot of them. But there were certainly a lot of things that were not natural. I mean, even our supermarkets are a little bit of a culture shock depending on where you come from. But I think it's really one of the most amazing testaments to this school is that kids would come never having left Afghanistan and come to America or Europe and enter into a college, you know, a freshman seminar where people are arguing with one another and be totally at home.
Do most of them return back to home to Afghanistan?
I think it's safe to say most of them do. Most of them have. It's hard now, and it's hard, you know, for me as someone who sort of feels beholden to this community a little bit. You want people to go back and help rebuild, but then on a personal level, you don't. It's a very kind of conflicting experience.
What about the Marifat students who went to Kabul University? What was their experience like?
A lot of them were crestfallen, really. Kabul University struggles to, I mean, it's certainly not like Marifat. It's not a place where you can have a lively debate about philosophy, for example. And there are professors there that are still using printouts from the internet as textbooks and 30-year-old articles and Wikipedia pages. And so kids who didn't get the scholarships to go out of the country would go to Kabul University and be, you know, kind of devastated and really disappointed. And it's one of the reasons why one of Aziz's fantasies is Amerifat University.
Haven't there been student protests and hunger strikes at Kabul U?
Yeah, there have. And in fact, Hazara students and Amerifat students have been involved in them.
And what are they protesting?
So 2 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, there was a big hunger strike that was focused mostly on discrimination, on the lack of quality professors, but mostly it was discrimination and harassment, and the feeling among Hazaras, especially Hazara women, that professors were deliberately trying to make life difficult for them so they would leave.
Does Aziz feel that he set up his students, especially the girls, for disappointment?
He wouldn't put it like that. He is trying to be more practical. He's looking at what's happening now and thinking, what do I do now? I've pushed these girls forward to stand up and protest and scream about getting the rights they deserve. Now if they do that without foreigners here to keep a lid on things, and now if they do that, it could get them killed.
Well, hasn't he backtracked on his own support to girl students and urged them to marry for their own protection?
Yeah, right. So he has. And he wouldn't...
Just being pragmatic there?
He's being pragmatic, and I think it breaks his heart, but I think that he has to look forward. And he asks. He says, you know, what do you do? Do you encourage girls to stand up and demand the rights that they deserve, even if it's going to get them hurt?
In February 2013, President Obama promised that we would withdraw half of our troops from Afghanistan. What was Aziz's reaction to that?
He was devastated. He should have known, but this is one of the things I keep telling people, because people keep saying, how did he not know that we were going to leave? We never stay somewhere forever. But when
Obama ran for president, he said he was going to withdraw troops.
Right. Well, and so there's a lot of evidence that we would not stay forever. I mean, it seems ridiculous, the idea that we would. But if you stood in Kabul in 2007 and looked around, you would have a really hard time believing that we were ever going to leave. We were just building and building and building. And, you know, all evidence that surrounded him contradicted the notion that we were going to start leaving, even though in the back of your mind, if you've ever read a history book, as Aziz certainly has, you know that we would.
And then all of the things that the school stands for, free inquiry, equal rights for women and ethnic minorities, will be in jeopardy.
Right. And I think there's also some cognitive dissonance here, because do you say, well, the U.S. troops are going to leave and that's going to be the end of us? I think it's easier to pretend that's not going to happen for as long as you can.
Amerifat has always been more than a school. It was the center of Hazara politics and culture as well. Didn't Aziz become more involved in politics?
Yeah. He initially helped Ashraf Ghani, who became the president, who's now the president of Afghanistan.
Ghani is Pashtun. Historically, mm-hmm. They've been the enemies of the Hazaras.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, Ashraf Ghani is a particular tribe within the Pashtuns called the Kuchis. They're nomads that come through traditionally Hazara land, and there's conflict every spring. So even within the sort of Hazara-Pashtun divide, Ashraf Ghani is a member of an ethnic group that there's particular animus between the two groups. And yet Aziz and Ashraf Ghani formed this bond. Now, it's since broken down. But Aziz thought that maybe the way to protect the school as foreign forces leave is to try to lever it into the political system somehow.
And Ghani supported education.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Is he, whether he has been a great leader or not, is he doing a better job than Hamid Karzai did?
I think it's probably too soon to tell, and I think that Ashraf Ghani is just a totally different background. I mean, he is an academic, and he has very sophisticated academic ideas of what to do, and I think what it looks like is it's not an environment that's very receptive to someone with those kinds of ideas. But, we hope that things turn around.
In December 2014, NATO formally ended combat operations in Afghanistan and transferred full security responsibility to the Afghan government. And from what I've been reading in the newspapers, that has led to some real problems.
Yeah. They just weren't ready.
So is that why President Obama has now decided to keep some U.S. forces in Afghanistan more than he had wanted?
I would venture to say that is the reason. I mean, if you can leave and train up the local army, you get to end a war without admitting defeat. And we've tried to. I mean, that's what we tried to do in Vietnam, right? And so we tried to do it here, and it hasn't worked.
Well, as I understand it, a majority of Americans don't want to make an endless commitment to Afghanistan. So what can we realistically do to limit the consequences of our leaving?
I honestly don't have a very good answer for that. And part of the reason I wrote the book was to really ask that question of, because I was conflicted about it. I don't want endless war, certainly. I don't support spending millions of, in this case, trillions of dollars and putting young men and women in harm's way forever in foreign wars. But I also believe in the value that this school has arisen to protect and promote. And here those things are in direct conflict. So which do you support?
Now, Al-Qaeda, which had a presence in Afghanistan, has pretty much been pushed aside. ISIS is now the real power. In Afghanistan, what is more of a threat, ISIS or the Taliban?
I think to us, probably ISIS. To them, for example, to Hazaras, people at this school, it's a little bit of both, because it seems like the Taliban is beginning to adopt more ISIS-style tactics. It's almost like they're jealous of the coverage that ISIS gets. And so you see this really gruesome violence, even more gruesome than Taliban is traditionally capable of. And one of the explanations is that they're trying to out-ISIS.
Now, you haven't just reported on Afghanistan. Didn't you also cover the Ebola outbreak from Guinea for Vanity Fair?
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh.
You just don't like to live safely?
I don't know. I don't know what it is, but there's people in all these places that I end up forming these really close friendships with, and it keeps bringing me back. I guess something about the extreme environments make it easier to make friends or something.
Can you tell us about your work with Afghan and American students to produce an interactive museum exhibition?
Oh yeah. So after my first stint in Afghanistan, I was there for about a year writing, but mostly working at the university, the American University of Afghanistan, and beginning to develop a relationship with this school. After that, I moved back to Philadelphia, where I'm from, and I got a job at the National Constitution Center there to international engagement, develop sort of modest, interesting education and engagement programs. So we got a grant from the U.S. State Department through the American Association of Museums. And what we did was we set up Marifat students, 10 Marifat students, with 10 students from a predominantly minority urban charter school in Philadelphia. And the two of them corresponded, the two student groups corresponded over the course of a year and produced a interactive documentary photography exhibit where there would be a photo by an Afghan student of, say, a mosque and a photo by an American student of, you know, the Comcast Center Tower in downtown Philadelphia. Or they would be a woman voting in Afghanistan, a woman voting in America. And the idea was that people would be struck by some of the differences, but also in some cases by some of the similarities.
You've also worked with a foundation to help Afghan women to enter the workforce. What kinds of jobs would be available to an Afghan woman in a culture that doesn't really respect them? And not all that long ago, didn't allow them out in public unless they had a male escort.
Well, there are actually some pretty inspiring success stories of women-owned and women-run businesses in Afghanistan. Sometimes it's what you'd expect. It's handicrafts and things like that. But there are some amazing institutions and organizations that are run by women, that are run by sort of the indomitable will of a few young women. And, I would say that there is space now. Maybe it's disappearing, but there's space for women to be leaders in Afghanistan, at least for the moment.
Women have run for political office.
Yeah, and women sit in parliament.
Are you planning to go back?
I think eventually I probably will, maybe for the Farsi book launch.
Jeffrey E. Stern, his book, The Last Thousand, One School's Promise in a Nation at War. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you. It's so good to be here. I appreciate it.